Welcome to the Tiny Plastic People podcast. It is the podcast which is about the tiny plastic people. We do paint them, we do play with them, and we're going to talk to you about why we think that is great. So this is the podcast of tinyplasticpeople.com. You can go there. There's things there. You can subscribe to things like this podcast. You can download games that we may have written. You can poke around and read articles. It's lovely. And on this podcast, on this very night, this Monday night, I'm not going to specify the date because that would put it in time and embarrass us about when it comes out, are two other people other than myself. So I'm joined by Alistair.
Hello.
And I'm also joined by Rachel.
Hello.
Hey, hey, hey. And I, of course, am James. So, as we are gathered around this audio buffet of questions and things to talk about, the first thing we usually do is talk about what we've been up to in our hobby. And number one on my list of people to talk to is Alistair, the birthday boy himself. What have you been doing in hobby?
Thanks. I have been doing things for Legions Imperialis, which I believe you have also. First thing I've been doing is printing up many small buildings and putting them together. So Legions, being a quarter of the scale of regular Warhammer, looks a bit strange. You put your regular 40k terrain next to it. Not always. Some stuff can work as cyclopean mega structures, but a lot of sort of like more human scale buildings look a bit weird. So there are lots of people who make nice files and things, so I've been printing up some of that and painting it. I think I have about enough for a table now, and I've also been painting some sort of auxilia tanks. So I've decided on my scheme, so I'm going to work on them. That's all green, because I really enjoyed Advance Wars, and I think Green Earth is my favourite faction.
Nice.
They're the ones who are green!
Your faction, whose opinions are green. And their whole outlook, green. Is there anything else that defines them other than green in Advance Wars? I've never played Advance Wars. I'm a baby.
Advance Wars, it's a strategy game, came out for Game Boy Advance, I think, originally. I've played a couple of them. Green Earth is one of the factions in it. The most, characterful things about them is each faction has different leaders who you can pick and play with. And Green Earth has some extremely cool ones, including Jess, who is my favourite. She's a tank commander. But yeah, I just always really enjoyed that. And the nice bright green pops nicely on the table, I think, for such small models. So that's why I went with it.
You shared a picture of them. And the bright green is also very, like, classic, epic looking.
Yeah, it does work with that as well, which is nice.
Very good.
People keep painting their Legion's armies quite dark, and that's not what I want to see. I want to see very punchy tanks with very vibrant color schemes, personally.
Yeah, I think it's difficult because so many 40k schemes are quite dark, and that works if the models are big and have sort of like a sort of brighter base, but when your models are so small, you can't really get away with it as easily. So I agree, it's a bit difficult to like get nice characterful models of that scale, which is one of the reasons I chose such a bright color scheme. Anyway, that's all I've been working with for now. Rachel, what have you been working on?
So I painted some elves, just a little trio to fill out a Warcry warband list that I wanted to run. Just some dark elves from my Seas of Sigmar. And subsequently, I have been painting Space Marines, which is very strange for me, because I don't really like Space Marines. But I decided to sort of sign up for a Kill Team Bad Up War meetup that we're doing in February. That, of course, everyone in the Bad Up War is a Space Marine, so I've chosen to do the Marines errant. I'm just doing my best to sort of go along for the ride and sort of challenge myself to do something different. And yeah, it's not all bad. I'm enjoying it somewhat. Yeah, I'm doing the Marines Errant, who are basically, I think they're sailors. And they also sometimes use Xeno's weaponry. So I've given a couple of my guys Eldar weapons. But it's okay because they have purity seals on them.
Mm.
So it's not heresy.
Definitely not heresy.
And it's a very silly color scheme where it's all white on one side and all blue on the other. Which is... I think it was fun for about the first Marine to paint, and subsequently I've just been like, why am I doing this? Just going back and painting. Like, obviously, like, the white part is pretty easy, because you can just do most of that with the airbrush. And then you have to go in and paint the other half blue by hand. And, yeah. Yeah, but I'm getting through it. I'm almost done, I think. And then
I think we're all just amazed that you're painting Marines at all.
It's hell. I don't know what I'm doing. Yeah. But like soon it'll be finished and then they can go in a box and be ready for the event, where I'm sure I will have lots of fun playing with my friends and killing Marines and getting Marines killed.
Some kind of heresy, which we all know and love.
I'm very excited to get them done, because then I can paint my my Loon Shrine and more elves and, you know, exciting things.
I'm just thinking given that these Marines are sailors and that they're dressed in blue and white, I just keep thinking of the Navy Marines from One Piece, which has been on Netflix recently. But they always have, like, Navy and Marine written on various pieces of their clothing. Which I feel could only enhance a Marine squad if they had Marine written on their helmet.
I am already having to psych myself up to do freehand chapter insignias on all of the shoulder plates. I'm not doing text as well. You can't make me do this. I will suffer from my art, but not that much.
You've given me a weird flashback to the first Space Marine colour scheme I ever came up with when I was in primary school. And I'm going to follow this up with a question, but mine was basically I used to draw lots of pictures of Space Marines in my exercise books, because that's what you do when you're in primary school and you know what Space Marines are and you think they're cool. And mine were the Toxic Marines, and they had the word toxic written down them. And then when my friend... said,
Slade.
Yeah. And my friend was just like, you can't write toxic that small. Only I can write toxic that small. So I paid him £2 to do it, and he couldn't do it. So,
hope you got your money back.
I don't think I did. I think I got some Tazos out of him or something, or some Pogs. But yes, what was your first ever conjured scheme for a Warhammer figure of any kind, be it Space Marines?
Me?
Yeah.
Gosh, I'm not sure, actually. My very first miniatures were either the Soldiers of the Last Alliance kit for Lord of the Rings, or some classic Wood Elf Glade Guard and some Bretonian Bowmen. It's very hard to say anything really about my painting when I was very wee, because I didn't really do it. I just kind of like I tapped out really quickly. I was like, wow, these paints suck, or this is too much work. I'm going to play video games instead. I don't know if you're asking about like adult experiences of coming.
I like the childhood hobby. Experience.
Yeah.
Alistair, you have a strange colour scheme. Well,
I initially painted some classic built-in Eldar, and some classic space walls. So those didn't have particularly inventive color schemes at all. But the first non-Catman's color scheme I guess I painted was I attempted to paint a space marine for a friend of mine at school, which was a marine in black and white with a yin-yang symbol on his shoulder pad, which was a transfer, and Neo written on the other. It was, to use the modern parlance, a bit cringe.
Hey, that sounds lovely. Unless when you were saying it was in school, it was like actually like college and university age, then you should have known better. But I think children know that. Perfect. Anyway, Rachel, sorry for the digression. Is there anything else on your painting or hobbying table other than space marines?
Nope. As I said, once I'm done these, it will be onto greener pastures, greener elfy and goblin pastures. Yeah, looking forward to that.
Do you think you'll paint a space marine ever again after this?
I could probably be tempted, but not for a while.
Awesome. Well, that just leaves me. And I'm actually going to roll into my topic of the podcast this time as well, because I too have been actually painting the tiny Legion Imperialis little tanks and all sorts. And I'm actually very proud of myself. I actually finished pretty much the Space Marine half. In fact, I say pretty much, I have finished the Space Marine half of the box, which is good because I sold the other half of the Solar Auxilia to fellow pod host B. And yes, I painted them as Alpha Legion. I was very happy with actually the scheme and everything. But there is a but in there. But I'll continue on with the painting for now, until I get to the but. But no, that's another but. Anyway, it has generally been they're really fun. Like Alistair painting the Solar Auxilia, I imagine they're just as fun as the Space Marine tanks. I feel the Space Marine tanks have more like clean edges, so you can kind of just fall back on usual painting techniques and stuff on them. But yeah, they're really good to paint, and I really enjoyed actually having a quick project, because they paint up really fast as well because they're tiny. The only thing that's an absolute ball ache is the troops, and I hate the troops. The troops can all get in the bin. I never want to paint another base of tiny space marines ever again. But unfortunately, due to the way the game plays, it looks like I'm going to have to paint another or double as many as I have so far. So that sucks. I don't know whether I'm going to embrace that or I'm just going to say, eh, and just never do it and just focus on buying the things I actually like about Epic, which is tiny robots, tiny tanks, and tiny planes. So yeah. Onto that but was the reason why I painted them so fast was I actually organized a wee meetup for a few of our friends in Warhammer World to actually play this game, because I thought, well, what's the point in painting all these tiny titans and tiny things, particularly the tiny titans. No one ever plays with titans. They had never had a game to play with them before. Try out what this game is actually like to play. And I will get onto the but now, which is your point, Alistair, about, or Rachel, I've actually forgotten which one of you made the point, about dark schemes on small things. Absolutely terrible to actually play with when you're playing on a table with other people.
Yes. All your guys just look the same, right?
All your guys look the same. And I was playing Pete's, so I painted Alpha Legion, and I've done them in dark blue color of kind of similar to the heavy metal modern style, not modern, but like the 40k style, with the sort of tealy bluey sort of color. And they were fighting against Pete's tealy green Sons of Horus, and we were forever pointing at buildings, saying, this unit is going to shoot at this. No, it's not. Why? Because that's my unit. Okay, I guess I'm not going to shoot with your unit then. And
it would be very Alpha Legion though, right?
It was.
Wait, in character.
I kept chuckling and saying all the catchphrases, all the funny ones. Yeah, genuinely, it was quite annoying playing that way. Particularly all the troops. And yeah, I guess onto my very brief hot takes on the game. In that it's good. I think it's pretty good. I like the way Titans work. I like the way tanks work. I like the way planes work. I don't like the garrisoning of buildings bit. It's really annoying. Mostly because you've got loads of bases of troops which you suddenly don't have to have on the board. So you just move them off the board and then you can either leave them surrounding the building or deploy them else, it's a bit messy when it comes to troops.
Yeah. That stuff always gets weird in games where the model's position is not actually where the model is, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I've seen a couple of discussions about how to try and like improve that situation, and about the only one I've seen is that you have some sort of on the side of the board sets of building like sheets which says this is a type of building that has these stats, like this armor save, this many hit points and things, and then when your unit goes into that building you put a flag on the building, put a flag next to that sheet, and then you put your pile of troops around the flag, so you know this is a bunker and it's got my guys in it, and maybe you leave one or two of the stands next to the flag as well to sort of show that they're there. But it's really awkward, you're right, because technically, well, it's very weird. There's almost no limit. I think it's like got 16 or something stands of troops can be in a building. It's absurd.
It's a lot. It's a lot.
And, like, yeah, I mean, it kind of makes sense, I guess, because most buildings are multiple story and Marines are
small.
Like,
yeah.
But at the same time, it's from the point of view of the game, it's a bit clown car-ish that, like, this huge mass of troops has just disappeared inside this small ruin.
Do Space Marines hold the door open for each other?
I think they sit there and go, after you, brother. No, after you, brother. Very polite. Depends on the chapter, I guess, though. I think they all differ. Yeah, I think the building stuff was the bit that kind of threw me the most. The other thing that got me was my brain going dead as I think of what it was, because it was on the tip of my brain and then it has slid off. Army construction, that's one thing that I didn't like very much, mostly because the box is weird, as it lots of people have said about. But it just feels like a game which is built around having lots and lots of troops, which is cool from a certain standpoint, but the way they work, the rest of the book, my point was going to be about the garrisoning buildings. It's really hard to get troops out of buildings, like using guns, which is fairly realistic, I guess. But what we found was we played on a table with probably too many buildings on it, particularly in our last game. And that also raises the point which lots of other people have made, which is 3,000 points is too much stuff on the table, and it's very slow. But yeah, but it feels like you should be blowing up buildings and troops should be like flying out of the buildings on fire and stuff, and like things should be rumbling to the ground while you just flatten a battlefield or something. It seems like it should be set out to do that, and it looks like it should be that kind of game. But it's not, because you can shoot a building, barely damage it because it's got a save of like 3+ on 2 dice, and you can only shoot it with certain weapons anyway, and then it just takes it down by 1 wound, and it's got 3 wounds at the end of this. So, yeah.
It is weird.
Things like that are a bit strange. It feels like it's just tuned in slightly the wrong places, but I will say, at like 1,500 points, had a really fun game with Pete apart from mistaking our troops for each other. And I think the way that 3,000 points, those bigger games work, is you actually, instead of taking up to 3,000 points of like troops and tanks and things, you say, we have like 1,000 points of titans, and then you take 2,000 points, or even less, you do like 1,500 points of troops and tanks and things.
Yeah.
Just to mean there's less moving parts on the table, but you do still get that sort of combined arms, everything happening at once and stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right. This probably is going to work. It's an interesting game. I haven't gotten to play it yet myself. I'm waiting for my friend to finish painting his stuff. But, yeah, it seems really cool. There are very few things that can kill a building, like, in one shot. I think that a Reaver with, like, one of its melee weapons can. And one of the bombers carries, like, a one-shot bomb that will just, like, annihilate just about anything, I think. But... It's a bit of a investment. And I was thinking about this because I've printed, as I mentioned, I've been printing buildings, but I've been printing mostly actual buildings that you can get into. And now I probably have too many. and I've been thinking about terrain that would go in a city which is non-garrisonable. So what sort of buildings could I put in a city that would not be, which would still provide interesting tactical opportunities, but not necessarily be something that people could live inside? And like things like giant statues, I guess. I'm going to build a couple of like industrial pump houses or warehouses. Then maybe people could stand on top of, but not inside, which, I mean, that'd be different.
Yeah.
Things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely a fun game. I think that was the thing I came away from the set thinking, like, apart from a few like specialist games, weirdsies, which I think they have like a limit of those, which basically is like, this game is going to be a bit shit up until this point, and then there's going to be all this really good stuff in it. And as long as that bit shit bit doesn't tip over and spill shit everywhere, I think they're onto a good one. So yeah.
Probably pretty accurate, yeah.
I'd like to try it. And... I know they won't do this because they said they won't do this, and you should just believe them when they say it. They should add non-imperial factions.
They absolutely should.
Yeah.
I think
I expect we'll see a, like, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I expect we'll see at least a fan supplement for Eldar and Orcs sooner rather than later. I mean, those factions are still actively played in Net Epic, which I think is the current most popular one, although there are a couple of other fan rule sets as well. And people have been passing old models back and forth or 3D printing ones for basically decades now. So even if Games Workshop doesn't support Eldar in the game, I'm sure that will be along soon rather than later.
Mm.
I do really like the scale they're working at as well. It's not 8mm. Is it 8mm?
It is 1/4 of 40K scale, and 40K doesn't really have a scale, so.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's like
8-ish.
Heroic epic scale. Let's call it that, or something rubbish. But the size of a titan, the size of a knight, and also the way things move around the table just looks good. And that is a thing that Games Workshop does do pretty well, is that if you've got two well-painted armies, they're fun to move around. A beautiful Thunderhawk just flew past our screen just then as well. Thank you, Anson. Yeah, it's a really good scale, I think, for a war game. And I guess that leads me on to just a little question before we wrap up this section of why is tiny games so good? Why is small games better than big games, or why could they be better than big games?
Spectacle. I haven't played like 40K Epic or Legions, but I have played Warmaster, and it's just like you get this real sense. It looks like an actual battle rather than like a few units kind of skirmishing. Like even in old Warhammer Fantasy Battle, like you really didn't have that many sort of moving pieces on the table, and it's not a particularly large area. Whereas in Warmaster, you can have like a little village over here, a little farmstead over here, a little river going between them, a forest over here, a mountain over here. It's kind of like a, you get more of a landscape to fight over. I think that's very appealing.
You get the real sort of like computer game real-time strategy effect, where it's like, yeah, I'm looking at this thing I can make on a computer, but to do it in Warhammer or in real life would require like a 12 by 24 foot table and more terrain than even James owns.
There's also like the rules can be, well, they have to be sort of less crunchy and less details oriented, as a, like, just because they're more zoomed out, and that's nice, and that lets the designer put like interesting mechanics and complexity and things like that in different places. So like Warmaster is all about the command rolls, and that's kind of interesting and weird.
I think you would find that like Legions is sitting just on the cusp of that. They have made things a little bit too granular in places, and you can really tell that's where it slows and grinds to a halt. And when you ignore those things, it's suddenly speedy and fast and fun and tactical again, where you yeet tanks around corners to get the right firing solution on like another group of tanks that have just moved, so you know that you can get behind them and things. So, yeah. Awesome. Well, I think small is better, and I do think that there is a Warmaster army in the future, having played Legions.
Which one?
Oh, I can't choose. That's the worst thing. Like, I love Wood Elves because they have a love of Wood Elves, but I also quite like High Elves in the tiny thing. Or the Eagles and the, like, fancy cone.
High Elves look like a lot of fun because they get a bit of everything.
Yeah. Throwers and things, delicious. And Griffins. So, classic fantasy army. I just love that sort of, is it 4th edition or 5th edition Warhammer with the big High Elf on the big bird griffin on the front. Just crazy cool rad art. That's what I like. Awesome. So on we go with the rest of the podcast, and we're going to move along to Rachel's topic of the show. So take it away, Rachel.
So I haven't fully collected my thoughts on this, so it's coming a bit off the cuff. But I'm painting these Space Marines, right? And, like, part of what's making them gradually turn into a bit of a struggle is that, like, it's January and I live in Scotland, and every day is the same miserable grey drizzle. It's cold. Or if it's not cold, it's just kind of like tepid. Just feeling a bit depressed. And that's not the Space Marine's fault, but maybe I'm kind of like taking out on them a bit by being like, oh, why isn't this hobby project bringing me more joy? I thought it'd be interesting to chat about the ways that our hobby relates to our mental health, and ways it can be a sort of a release mechanism for sort of getting back to feeling better, or calming down, or relaxing, or just kind of helping to ignore problems for a while, or even ways that it can maybe become a bit of a kind of like a source of stress and a negative mental health modifiers, that sort of thing. I think for me, like when I got into the hobby several years ago, it was a way for me to like stop doing what I was normally doing in my spare time, which was just either play video games or write, or like do sort of hobby game dev. And I am a game developer for my day job, so I was basically just spending all my time looking at a computer screen and thinking about writing code and all that sort of thing. And then I had like this other way to direct my kind of like creative energy that felt a lot more kind of like healthy and rewarding, and the sort of projects that I undertook in it were much smaller in scope, and like I could get quicker wins, and that was much better for my mental health than being like, oh, I'm gonna make another video game in my spare time that I won't finish, but that sort of thing. And sort of over the years, I've kind of grappled with like the process of lining up army projects and war bands and individual painting one-off things, and sometimes getting a bit like overwhelmed with all of this stuff that I feel that I need to do, and it's like, that's not, I don't actually need to do it. It's my hobby. And then I check myself and I realize that I don't have to do any hobby that I don't really want to do. And it's supposed to be fun. But sometimes you do kind of like set challenges for yourself, and like this warband, and you do kind of push yourself into new areas, and sometimes that can be like a bit challenging, because then this thing that you're supposed to do to like relax or to feel kind of good about yourself becomes like a bit of a source of anxiety. And I know that certainly there's a lot of people I know who quite often, or like either accidentally or on purpose, or I guess just force of habit, end up, or maybe even like this is what they enjoy genuinely, is like turning the hobby into kind of like a source of stress and an outlet for I don't know, how should I put this, making things difficult for themselves, or being very, it's like a way for them to be self-critical about their artistry and that sort of thing. And I don't know, I'm just kind of rambling at this point. What ways have either of you sort of noticed or found that hobby interacts with your mental health?
Alistair, would you like to I was about to use horrible interview technique to say, Alistair, what would you like to reflect on that?
you really have been interviewing people all day.
I really have, yeah.
I mean, yeah, I definitely resonate with a bunch of the stuff you said, Rachel. My own mental health's been up and down. Last year had some different like down points, I think. And I saw a direct correlation with that and my actual hobby output, in that when I was not feeling so good, then my motivation was way down, and I keep a spreadsheet of my goals completed, which, I mean, I don't know if that helps or hinders any sort of like sort of mental state, but I think that on the whole it helps, because I do like seeing a hard number of like, I have done the thing, because I very quickly will forget that I've actually completed a couple of squads or whatever. But even so, last year wasn't good. I think I burned myself out really early. I mentioned about it, talked about it in our Christmas pod, but I spent way too much time on some models for a painting competition in sort of end of February last year. And those ended up coming out quite well, but I put so much time and energy into them at the expense of everything else that it left me drained. And then I couldn't get into hobbying, and that sort of had a feedback effect of like, oh, well, I felt like I had all this hobby stuff that I could be doing, that I wasn't getting into any of it. That wasn't good either. And I think that that sort of like is my greatest weakness with this stuff, is either setting up a project which I kind of expect myself to have been working on, or take on multiple projects and then be sort of stunlocked between all of them, where I can't get anything started because I feel like I should be working on something else, or I can't decide. That doesn't work out so well. And then when I finally do get into doing things, it can turn into a bit of a mania where I just suddenly just spend all of my free time working on things. I mean, I've churned out over 30 little buildings already this month, as well as some little tanks. So just, yeah, there's some vibes, oscillation between extremes, which probably isn't good either. Yeah, I mean, I think it's as much with anything, it's difficult to think about the stuff. And I mean, maybe this is true of all hobbies, but maybe we just are more introspective about it because we talk to each other about it. But you can really get like obsessed with anything, I suppose. And just like, just as bad as people can get completely absorbed in their work and work too much, I guess your hobby can also become an unhealthy part of like an obsession and like an excuse to like not do things with other people.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to use the word work, because I sometimes find myself kind of transforming hobby into work, and it becomes a way for me to like feel good about my lack of productivity in other areas of my life. Like maybe work is like actual work is a bit slow and I'm not feeling like I'm getting very much done, but I'm really knocking these goblins out, stuff like that. Mm. Right, where I'm kind of tying my self-esteem to my output, if that makes sense.
Well, I mean, like, I guess that is something in the modern day, which is like a valid output, right? Because everyone needs something that gives them self-esteem. And in our modern society, to use the phrase, it's difficult, right? Like your friends and family might not necessarily be interacting you within ways that they see your like, obviously they're not going to be interacting with you in a way they see your like accomplishments or achievements at work, at your actual workplace. So you know, and most workplaces are not very good at giving people feedback about how well they're doing, just the nature of modern capitalism, I suppose. And you need that validation from somewhere. And for a lot of us, I guess it comes from painting tiny mans or from tiny peoples. And I mean, often we can find our own social groups online, which do give us nice feedback about these things.
Yeah, actually, like, it's probably this social aspect of the hobby that's been the biggest, the big thing for my mental health, is like connecting with all these people who share similar passions to me and getting to kind of like develop relationships with friendships with them and meet up with them in real life and play games and stuff. And that's really like really good for my brain. And that's not like that, I think that's like unambiguously positive, and there's nothing really bad, I think, going on there. I'm not like trying to show off or compete or be the greatest at being a hobby friend or anything like that. It's just, yeah, it's just great. What about you, James? What are you thinking?
Just active listening as much as I could to make sure that I can respond. Because yes, I think all of those things are true of me as well. Both of you, like the way you described the hobby as both a tool for aiding your mental health and also having negative impacts as well. And I was trying to think about how I relate to, the thing which I definitely struggle with the most is overreaching projects. Who would have thought? And not so much that I know I can't do something, because I know I can do things, and particularly if I set a goal, I usually set what I think is a realistic goal. But the point where that becomes something that is impacting other parts of my life negatively is often not the point when I will stop that project or realign where that is. So for me, that's like the danger zone where I am suddenly prioritizing something. I could easily stop that thing. I could make that not my priority. I'd reprioritize and go do something else, or just say pack it away for a little bit. But instead, what I will often do is double down on it until it's done, and then I'll burn out.
Yeah. And sometimes that, I don't know if, like, personally I'm okay at avoiding this, because I'm quite disciplined about, like, getting to bed and stuff like that, but I find, like, I often see people kind of, like, staying up late to finish their hobby projects and stuff like that, and I'm sometimes guilty of doing this myself, and it's like, yeah, I think that's kind of, like, where it's being prioritized over more important things, like getting a good night's sleep.
Yeah, and honestly, a good night's sleep is so good. I've been trying my best to make sure I do things like my phone charger is in another room now. So I have to charge my phone away. I've got an actual alarm clock and things like that, little things to just make sure that when I go to bed and things, I'm actually going to bed. It's like, it's sleep time. But anyway, we're talking about hobby and not sleep. The thing which I scribbled a note down was that I find not, like, the act of hobby is very relaxing to me, generally. Painting a model, despite not getting round to it, I don't find, like, the whole, that bit stressful too much. If I've got a lot to do and there's an event or something, it gets a little bit of pressure, but usually, normally, like, I've got to work through these Legion Imperialis troops. I realize that they're horrible. I can chunk that down into, like, okay, well, I'll just paint them all on the sprue, do this, and then work through them. And it's a few nights' work because they're not too bad.
Yeah. And the thing and it's that... nice. Sorry. Can I interject? Like, you it's can. Nice to have, it's nice to have, be able to do that with a project, right? Whereas, like, I often find in real life, there's just things coming up and nothing's ever that simple and everything's so frustrating, whereas with kind of like hobby projects you can just be like, okay, I'm gonna do a bit every night and then it'll be done.
Exactly. Yeah. And real life usually is someone breathing down your neck saying you've got to get this done by this date, and if it doesn't happen you've got nothing for that date, and then everyone's angry or this goes horribly wrong and capitalism comes for you. But the part which I was going to sort of divert onto is, like, there's also some, like, habits which get ingrained in the hobby, which is sometimes reinforced by the social group. So it's probably the only bit which I think is a little bit dangerous about getting into social groups where they're very focused on hobby, or very focused on a hobby. And that is almost like the habit of buying new things, or starting a new project, or if you're into more tournament scene, being on top of that tournament scene by having to purchase more things, and then that leads to a lot of money being spent on this thing. So I think there's a financial habit, and this is something which I sometimes struggle with, is that I will buy things I don't need. Or I will invest into a project without really knowing how much it's going to cost me. So I will start and then I'll go, oh, well, for this Legion's army, I need to buy that and buy that. And I ain't got no money until February now. So because I have to, with air quotes, invest in this thing to make that thing work, when actually I don't have to do that. Really. I just need to talk to the person I'm going to have a game with and say, is it okay that I just take these Titans, please? Because I just don't want to play with those rules and I don't have those models. So, or lend me some models. Or is it okay that we use some proxy models or something? Or is it fine that we fight around some books? It's perfectly fine. It doesn't make the game any worse, really, when it comes down to it. But there is that financial squeeze, which is put on all, it's in video games as well. It's like, you must play the latest game, you must play the most fancy new game that Games Workshop have come out with. The old world is out. Are you pre-ordering? Are you in the queue? Have you got your Bretonians? Have you chosen your Tombkins? Have you 3D printed yourself a new army? Have you got a new project because of this new game coming out? And that is the bit where I find there is danger for me.
Yes,
and it can get overwhelming, I think. And I've been looking at some of my stuff that's in my garage lately, and I'm just like, this is overwhelming. I'm feeling like I'm drowning in stuff. I don't need it. How can I get rid of it as quickly as possible? And then I make dumb decisions like, I'm going to sell it, or I'm going to give it away, or I'm not going to, I'm going to find a way to get rid of it, basically. Yeah. And then that often ends up with regrets. But
yeah.
So it's like, okay, just like taking a step back and before leaping into new projects is a step back before painting like one test model of that thing that is going to be a long time thing, I guess. Yeah. There's loads of positives. The community side is genuinely, like, it's not even just like, I have a new friendship group. They actually are friends now. Like, they fully are pretty much the people I hang out with and speak to the most. So it's like, well, you're all my friends. Soz. Ha! So, yeah.
That all rings true to me. I feel like we've solved mental health
finally
by talking about this, so I guess we can move on.
We can indeed. We can take the capital M and the capital H away from mental health, and it can just be pushed under like a webinar or something for people. I don't know. Alistair, you've got a fun topic for us.
Yeah, well, this is a bit of a short one. So I was thinking about things to talk about, and I was thinking about, well, actually, Rez, I've been thinking about my paint collection recently, in that I, speaking of buying things that you don't need, have, over the last, I guess, 5 years I've been in the hobby, bought really quite a lot of paints. Either I bought, like, sometimes I buy them in sets, and sometimes I buy a paint because it looks cool on a shelf, or sometimes I see it in a YouTube video, and I'm like, ooh, I definitely need Hull Red, because Squidmar used it, and, like, he's a good painter, so I should buy that too. And as a result, I have quite a lot of paints. But I always tend to use the same paints, I've noticed, even though I'm painting different projects. I'll use the same sort of like fallback paints over and over again. So I just was wondering, like, what paints do you get stuck with? Or do you have like a set of favorite, like 6 to 10 paints that you always use on every project? I mean, that might not be a bad thing. Just sort of, I've been curious. Rachel, you certainly have bright colors that seem to come up a lot.
Absolutely. Like, I always end up using, there's like this kind of little stable of Citadel paints that I always come back to. I just seem to find myself using just like the sort of general kind of primary color type ones, like your Corn Red. That is a good red, right?
Oh,
there.
Yes. That is a damn good red. Covers everything.
Yeah, there's just like, and increasingly, like, as I become a more experienced painter, I find myself just like, it doesn't matter that I've kind of like got a lot of blue paints, because what will always happen is I'll take one of them and then just mix it with white or black or whatever other color to get to the point I want. Because that's actually easier for me now than it is to, like, stand up and lean forward and get the actual paint that I want off of my shelf. So what other colours do I really love and keep coming back to? I think there's some contrast paints that have, like, really wedged themselves in my vocabulary, like Skeleton Horde.
Hell yes.
Universally useful. Blue. Mm-hmm. Pterodon Turquoise. Mm. So good. Gore Grunt of Fur for that sort of lovely reddy brown. And just like you could probably, there's like lots of these have sort of like equivalents in other ranges by other producers, but I think with paints you become so habit driven that you'll never you might buy them, but you'll never actually switch to them.
Yeah.
I find a lot of the time.
Part of that's a sort of like, I mean, sometimes it might come down to laziness, like you don't want to get different blue out of the cupboard. But I think some of it also comes from simply being familiar with the properties of a paint.
Yes. Like, and it isn't just the color, is it?
Yeah, all that stuff. I mean, I use Vallejos as most of my paints, and those vary wildly within a single range. So if I know that ivory is good, and it is, I'm going to use it all the time. But James, do you have any sort of like paints that you are always returning to?
Yes. Yeah. I've got like kind of, I try and do every time I start like an army project or something, I try and like find a new color to work with, or like at least a main color. But one, they will always come from the Citadel brand. Because I am lazy, I do not want to play around outside of it, and I feel like I understand most of the paints, and also they're very good at telling you like the scale of their paint schemes. Scale is the wrong word. Drew would tell me exactly what the correct word is. But it's like, to do this specific highlighting scheme, it is this paint, this paint, this paint, and this paint. And then that's what you need to do that color. And you can highlight it up, highlight it down. But a little bit like Rachel, I've been, particularly with my Titans, actually, I really love Calibite Green. Even though, it is green. It's like a turquoisey green, but it is quite green. And it's a lovely color. I love it. And I've wanted it to be the main color of an army for a long time. With a gold trim. Love a gold trim with green. Very classy. Mm-hmm. But to get the highlights on it, just mixing it with Wraith Bone really is to get like a sort of creamy, like keep the warmth of the green, because it is quite a warm green to me. And mixing it with cream got that, kind of kept that there. And then just doing like a dot highlight at the end with White Scar was enough to pull that then back to being not like a bony color, but like just have that gloss to it, even though it's like flat paint. And then Into the Recesses was just, I'm just going to mix it with Black Legion because it's kind of wet and just run it in. It's fine. And yeah, just mixing that. And it turns out that mixing paint, you can just do it every time after a while. You just get exactly, you go, oh, it's a dot of that, it's a dot of that. And then I've got exactly the same color. Here we go. So yes, I love those two. Well, Calibite Green, that's one which I've wanted to work with for ages. And is now working. And I was just going in my paint drawer to find another couple of workhorses of mine. Cantor Blue, sick ass blue.
It's really nice and saturated.
Yeah, I like a paint that just also just goes on the model and doesn't multiple layers.
So one thing that has made these marines a bit trickier than I would like is that Thousand Suns Blue is just not as like, it doesn't go on in one coat, especially over white.
Yeah.
And that is suffering to me. I just want to put one coat on and be done.
Mephiston Red, another one which just goes on in one coat as well. Unless you're like using it as a proper base coat and then you need to do loads and then it sucks. And I don't use an airbrush or anything fancy. I am just a baby putting it out of the pot onto the brush and then onto the model and then wondering why it looks streaky. Balthazar Gold, we'll use that forever. I think that's great. Even though it's not, is it gold, really? It's brass. It's fine. Those are pretty much like colors I always come back to. And it's telling that the army I hated painting the most, even though it worked out okay in the end, was the Custodes, and they are white, and I just don't like painting that color, it turns out. It's a nice scheme, it looks good, but I didn't like painting it. Whereas Admech is blue. It's Cantor blue. Very easy. Loved it. I like easy things. I'm worried about the Dark Angels, which are sitting on my desk looking at me, because those are trying to do like really dark green, but with bright highlights. And that's an interesting challenge. But I got to know a new set of greens to do it. So that was fun. Like learning about new greens. Paints, they're good. I won't buy anything other than Games Workshop because I'm a mark. So.
Do you make good paint? So fair enough.
I think it is good paint. Like, I've used it to fix things in the house. Like, it genuinely, like, good quality. I don't think anyone can, well, people can argue that by that. But
I think some of the paints are less good than others.
I get that metallics.
A lot of them are great.
I find, like, there's also something really soothing about knowing their range. A bit like I said about the, like, you learn the, like, if you want this specific color, they will teach you that color, and you can just copy what they tell you to do, and it will look good. And they've really nailed it. Like, if you watch the Heavy Metal Masterclass or their painting videos, you can do that. It's not that hard. Like, once you've mastered a brush, once you've mastered roughly how they're doing their mixing down, which is probably the hardest bit about any of those videos, is getting the paint to the consistency that they actually mean when they say, oh, do it a bit like milk. It's like, what the fuck does that mean?
Unhelpful descriptor.
Yeah. It's like, you can put water into Cantor blue and it will just be opaque forever. And you will just have water, which is blue. So, not great. But yeah, it's great. I like them. Can't be bothered to change. Yeah. All right. Right, we're going into question zone. Sound the horn.
Toot, toot.
It's question time. So we reached out to many of our lovely friends on the Role Models Discord. You can be part of the Role Models Discord by finding the link on Tiny Plastic People. You can go there and be friends with us too. And we will embrace you as one of us. Chant one of us at you. Or not. You might be a jerk, but if you're a jerk, you're probably not listening. Anyway, we're moving on to questions. So that's a nice transition, which I can use to edit around that if I need to. Right. Our friends have sent us some questions, and the first question is from Respectable Geek. Respectable Geek has asked us the Horus Heresy hot takes. The final book has been published. Do we love it? Do we hate it? And what is next? Are we any heresy experts here?
Sadly, I do not know anything about heresy.
I'm glad it's over. Glad that's all sorted out.
They finally sorted it all after all that time.
Good, that means it's over. The galaxy can be at peace, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Seems it. No spoilers here. I'm 7 hours into the last book. So, it's definitely a heresy of some type. I personally have really enjoyed the Siege of Terror side of it. Having someone come in and sort of do the stupid Marvel thing, which I realized that I have been completely duped by, is where you announce you're going to do all this stuff and then you just do it, is fairly ballsy for a book publisher, I think, to say we're going to write an 8-book series, and it's going to finish off a 50-odd book series, and then actually do it and add more books into it as well. That takes a bit of cojones of some kind, and generally was quite good. I think most of those books were very fun, schlocky, comic book movie-esque, sort of fun to listen to. I'd never read them with my eyes. I think that'd be poison. But yeah, I enjoyed it. Particularly the last one. No spoilers for the last one, but I think that the way Dan Abnett writes the sort of like mind-bending combat, which is like going on in towards the end of these books, where reality is falling apart. It's very much like someone describing Doctor Strange to you. Literally, like the films. Like, it's just like in great detail. And it's quite good. It's enjoyable and it's fun, but it is definitely like candy for the brain that I will forget most of it by the time it's over. So that is Hot Takes on the Heresy, which is now over, apparently.
Yeah, I was reading the Gunhammer review in preparation for this question. And yeah, I had kind of like not entirely appreciated how long Heresy has been going for, and like it just like it kind of came out of nowhere, really. Like, I don't know if they really, when they started out, they really envisaged that they'd be going for so long the whole way through. But it really picked up momentum as they went over the 20 years or so. It's nuts when you think about it. It's a huge amount of sort of time and writer hours and effort, and it's very impressive, even though I'll never read any of it. You gotta hand it to him.
Yeah, gotta hand it to him. It definitely feels very product managed at the end, I would say, if you've ever worked in a business that involves a lot of product management. You know it when you see it, and it's right there on the pages and in them saying, you gotta finish this. These are the people who are gonna finish it. Go and finish it, please. And it definitely feels like that. But that doesn't mean it's bad, but it does mean all the arguments which you can make about why someone like myself, who would say, I don't like any of the Marvel movies anymore, would also not like what has happened to the Heresy, in that there is so much of it. It is very, like, each book on its own. They kind of tread the same stuff nearly all the time, or at least, like, have these little fan service-y bits where, oh, and this is the bit where the Space Marines explode people. They're quite like that. And I can completely see it. They're very comic booky, really. It is like comic books, but words, but audiobooks, because I won't read the words. So, yeah. There we go. Any final takes on the Horus Heresy, and then we can never talk about it again?
No, I had none to begin with, I think. I'm going to call out the last little bit of Respectable Geek's question, which was, what's next?
Oh, of course, yeah.
I presume he means from Black Library. And to spin that out into a sort of like quick brainstorm, I'd say I'd really like to see a series of equivalent length about the fall of the like Age of Heroes in, is it the Age of Heroes in Age of Sigmar?
Age of Myth?
Yes, of the ending of the Age of Myth and the like beginning of the Age of Chaos.
Yeah, because... so there have been a few stories about that, and it is like really cool to kind of see the world that Sigmar and the other gods built up, and how it all went a bit rubbish. I think that'd be a project of kind of similar scope and interest to me, with all the gods sort of getting together and then falling out. I worry that it would fill in parts of the setting that I don't really want to be filled in. But that's a risk that I'd be willing to take.
How many books do you think it should take?
12. Perfect. Because that's Sigmar's favorite number.
Nice. I think I'd like to see, like, an equally not quite a 60-book series, thank you very much, but maybe, like, three or four, or just, like, a small, decent size sort of telling of, like, the fall of the Eldari. That would be nice. Like, because that would be...
Wouldn't book one just be really horny?
Hell yeah.
I think that touches upon a point, which is that I just like generally for there to be for like all of the energy that they put into Horus Heresy to just kind of go into filling out other sort of factions and characters in the universe, because they're like as far as I can tell there just haven't been any Eldar books for like a decade or something like that, and that's really
sad.
That's
true.
I think the last ones were around the Yennari stuff in 8th. Yeah. So that's at least 6 years ago, I guess, now. Which is time spinning away. Yeah. And that was like the last time Eldar got some kind of new things. Not like new models, because they've just redone the old models. Like that was like actually new stuff. Yeah. Anyway, we've got questions. We've got them coming at us. So, the next question flies from, Loop, who has asked us, what are your favorite Kitbash concepts for Cities of Sigmar armies? Rachel, as the AOS person.
Yes, yeah. And as a Cities of Sigmar enjoyer, I've always wanted to do kind of, like, Sylvaneth-y infused humans and stuff. So like in the lore you sometimes get described like iron bark or iron wood armor or iron oak or something like that, and it's like it's just tree but it's as hard as metal, and I think it'd be quite cool to see if it was possible to transform the armor of like a demigryph knight or a cavalier, or basically any of the things. Some of them already have like wooden shields, but just like all of the metal pieces, so that they had like the what do you call it, grooves, striations that you find on wood, that sort of thing. I think that'd be really cool. Not really necessarily conversion so much as, or kitbash so much as like actually sculpting, but you'd possibly want to sort of bring in lots of Sylvaneth bits for that. That's just the stuff off the top of my head. Yeah. You can really go nuts with Cities because ERS is such a like wacky setting, I think.
Yeah. I think surprising no one, I'd kitbash them with Beastmen. there's actually in the Thondia book, when the curse is sort of like taking hold all over the realms, there's there are various like towns which are being like transformed into beast men or into animals and things.
Yeah,
and...
but not necessarily chaotic ones, right?
No, that's the thing. They like the Stormcast rock up and they're like, well, where are all the people and why are all these like animals wearing ragged clothing? And the sort of most human-ish left people come up and they're like not violent. They're just kind of like, yeah, this is kind of how what's happened now. Can you fix it?
This is our mayor. He's a pig.
We all voted for him. Which was nice.
After he was a pig.
Just like his pig-friendly policies.
Yeah, exactly. But there's some weird stuff that happens in some of those books that I'd go for the weird.
Ooh, I'm trying to think. There was some... very on-point observations that I would turn them into Mechanicus stuff, and there is the example of that. Yes, I have been turning them into Mechanicus stuff. There's a little Skitarii having a walk, because...
So James is holding up a Free Guild Steelhelm who has a arquebus. What are they called again? Is it transuranic arquebuses?
These are just the Stanic galvanic rifles. Yes, the long rifle.
Of course.
The standard one. So, yes, I would do that, and I have done that. But for AOS, I think I'd want to do something. Well, the bit of AOS that I really like and I haven't really had much of a chance to work on a lot of is vampires and things. So I'd quite like to do kind of like Realm of Deathy Cities of Sigmar, but I have no idea how I would make that work, but I would definitely really want to kind of capture more, like they've got this really good blend of like witch hunters and things in a lot of the sort of characters, which are like the underworld characters, and the, there was just one announced with a lamp, which got me very excited. And I really like that rickety, Bloodborne-esque sort of side of Age of Sigmar, which they've just kind of just said, yeah, yeah, we can do that. And we do it well. So I wonder what a Cities of Sigmar army would look like. But yeah. I have no idea how it would differ from, like, I just kind of like the ragged townsfolk side, I think. I think I'd make them look more like peasants and things. Like, I love the new models. The new models are sick as hell. The model which they previewed for the Warhammer events, that new one with the bird, that one
it's incredible.
Rocks. And it is so sad that it is
event exclusive.
Yeah,
I know. I'm going to be quietly seething about that for the next several weeks,
because that's kind of the look that I really go for. Like fantasy stuff, I think, and really gets, well, goblins as well. I love goblins, but dark, evil, bloodborne-y, weird, old, bashed up knights that have got horrible mental illnesses or just trauma and things from decades of fighting. Yeah, that stuff's cool. Not for them, but for me. I'm painting them. Awesome. Next up, let's go on to a question from Ruvin. We've talked about paint already. Sorry, John. And you've got another question, which was better. So, props to you, John. Ruvin says, everyone's busy speculating about what they want to see from the old world. Please give us your most curmudgeonly and far-out takes about what you least want to see from the old world. Hate for Emperor emoji. Hate for Emperor emoji. Hate for Emperor emoji.
Damn, this guy must love the Emperor.
It's really into it. Any of y'all into the old world, first of all, got tempted back by Bretonians?
No, not really. I was kind of reflecting on this earlier a bit, where it's like I didn't really get to board the fantasy battle train as a kid. Like, I had like one unit of Dark Elves, and I tried learning the rules, and then I sold them. So I don't really have the nostalgia button for GW to push as such. But I do like a lot of the old models, and I kind of just want them to exist in AOS.
Yeah, I also don't have strong feelings. I don't have strong feelings about the old world so much, in that I have no attraction to it. I missed out completely, I think, on Warhammer Fantasy Battles, and I think that Age of Sigmar just does everything cooler that it tried to do. I guess what I least want to see from the old world is for it to like become the mainline game, I suppose. So to take the hottest take, I want Age of Sigmar to remain around because I think it's a more vigorous and imaginative setting.
I'm not worried about that happening.
Yeah, I guess. But yeah. If you want to see like far out take, there you go.
What do I want to say? I did see it, people playing it, because we actually went to, when we played Legions in Warhammer World, it was the day after the release of the old world. So they had all the big displays up. They had all the heavy metal cabinets out still. And the models look sick as hell, but particularly the new ones, the Bretonians on foot. Yes, please. They look nice. What do I least want to see from it, though, is, I don't know, just I want to see people playing it because it looks very cool. People were playing it and it looks nice. I think the thing which I want to happen the least though is that they keep releasing everything in metal and resin and they don't put out very many plastic kits that I can cut up and turn into other things because I don't want to be converting resin. I don't want to be converting metal. So, the most curmudgeonly take I can do is their, release platform is, I think it's cool, actually, that they're bringing back old models. I think that's great, that they're bringing back old kit, that they're doing it a good service. It looks kind of pricey. But it's good that they brought stuff back. Why wouldn't that be good? Really. So, yeah, I just, don't want to see any more of that metal.
Yeah, did he ask for curmudgeonly takes, though?
Yeah.
The rules suck, sorry. They are just fucking garbage. And if you enjoy them, then you're wrong.
Yeah, I discussed earlier the Specialist Games shit tank, which goes into all of their games, and this one looks like it's full. Okie dokie. Speaking of Specialist Games, they've got another question coming right at you. Another one from Loop, which says, given that they've recently vaguely announced a supplement for the Middle-Earth strategy battle game, what would the coolest thing it could possibly be?
Second Age.
Which one's the Second Age?
Last Alliance shit. So going and beating up Sauron the second time? Yeah. Yeah, Last Alliance stuff, it would be lovely to see a sort of supplement in that vein. Maybe we could, if we were very good and lucky, get a new Sauron sculpt. Because the old one is like the first ever or Lord of the Rings mini, and he's just kind of a big block of metal.
Thick, weighty boy.
I think the coolest thing that we could see for Middle Earth is actually just more plastic kits. Because I think the design for Middle-Earth is so very different from Games Workshop's other work that, like, it's basically an interesting sort of branch in their design philosophy, right? And it would be cooler to have... It would be nice to have, like, access to those models in more cost-friendly and kitbash-friendly materials.
The plastic one, like, the characters which they released, like, last year, the year before, like, they were stunning, some of those. They were so good. Models of people that actually look like the people who they look like in the film.
I think that's unfair. A lot of the old metal models do bear likenesses to their actors. At least I think so. But that might just be because I've watched the film so many times that I'll basically see any kind of object and Pareidolia Viggo Mortensen onto it.
And I am just going to plead ignorance that I don't know what the coolest thing it could possibly be, because I've actually yet to play the Middle-Earth strategy battle game. The coolest thing it could be is a cheap box set which is appropriately and attractively priced for me to get into the game.
Didn't you just say that you shouldn't buy new things all the time, James?
Appropriately priced. Maybe it's a skirmish game. Maybe it's like Necromunda.
Okay. I'll accept that as like an excuse.
Orc Necromunda. So it's like set in Mordor. And you're all competing for the Dark Lord's affection.
Amazing.
And you get to make your own orcs.
And you get to figure out what meat can go on their menu and run their restaurant.
Nice.
All right. So, Kara has two questions for us. We have, how many of the predictions will get out of date between recording and the release of this podcast?
Probably all of them.
Yep, I agree. All of them. And the next question is, what do you think needs to change in AOS 4?
I have strong opinions about this.
Let's go into
I want them to change, like, basically everything. I want them to do a 10th edition type, like, rethink of a lot of the design.
Where would you start?
Oh. Well, if it were up to me, I'd really, like, streamline it even more. I'd get rid of lots of things. I'd get rid of the wound roll. That would make me happy. Less ambitiously, like, I think they should make spellcasting work the way it does in Old World and kind of like in 40k, where it kind of it happens when it's relevant rather than doing it in your hero phase and then having to kind of like track the effect for a little until like the phase later on when it's relevant. That would be a nice little win. I don't know. I could go on about this at great length. And I can do it in person with Kara. So
take that then. I would personally like to see the way you build armies change. I don't know how, because I don't build AOS armies very much at all, but I can kind of tell from the way people talk about the overall tournament meta of the game that the way you build an army is not the way I would want to build an army. And I feel like it just needs to, well, this is just for my taste, so everyone can say that I'm wrong, but it just needs to be a bit easier to take the shit that you want to take in an army. And it actually kind of synergize or kind of do the thing it's supposed to do. A bit like Dread say it, like a Space Marine army, in the way that you will put, like I say, a character with an army and then that unit just does the thing. Sorry, army unit. And it just, that unit gets a buff from the character, and then you can kind of tweak your units to do what you want them to do by putting different characters with those units. That very 10th edition sort of, like, they get all the keywords, they get everything from that character, and it can also make the character worse, because the character can then get targeted by other things due to the unit which you put them with and stuff. I quite like that about 10th, and I don't get that flavour from AOS.
I like attaching heroes to units. That's really cool. Because otherwise, to make heroes cool, you'd have to make them actually good at going and doing things, which they just have never been at any point in AOS's lifespan.
Yeah.
I think that what I would change, I think this does need to change. Let's go with a hard take on this, is that I think that they could lean much harder into the keywording system. I know that units currently have keywords and that sometimes they interact with each other. Mostly for the application of like army rules, but I think that like you could really go hard like modern RPG design does, where all abilities and things have a collection of keywords and those might interact with each other in different ways. Like certain things an obvious example would be like, if a undead unit has the undead keyword and some things just do more damage to undead, that's an easy global thing.
They Whereas did currently have we that have back this... in second, Castigators got
yes,
extra damage against undead.
I think everyone that, like, that hated kind it. Thing... well, I mean, everyone that's like sort that. Of an example could be applied to more of the game design, I think.
I guess it's quite hard to have, like, a skill that is specifically good against another type of army. But yeah, it's almost a shame that, like, the order, chaos, destruction, death isn't kind of like more of a rock beats scissor beats thing, and you have to do specific things to make an army good against, like, another one. But then you're getting into, like, well, if I bring this army, I'm just going to lose against that army.
Yeah, I think that maybe, don't necessarily focus on my example. I was just using it as an extremely obvious like use case for keywords. I just meant the ways in which
maybe
rules
like unit size,
can be made much more simple. The other thing I think about AOS constantly is that I think that melee range needs to get in the bin.
Oh god, yeah.
Yes.
I think that like people should just fight in ranks, and like then you could just get away with all of the unnecessarily fiddly like pile in step where you're trying to like maximize the number of people and everyone who has a 32 millimeter base and 1 inch reach, which is most people, gets screwed over.
Yeah. I was thinking just the sort of same thing, like making, it's a game about big glowing golden supermen bashing weird ghosts and weird meat men and other things. Just make it so that they, when they smash into each other, they all fight. Why not?
Yeah.
And they have to stay in coherency so you don't like daisy chain them across things. They just automatically pile in no matter what happens, and they all fight all at once.
Yeah, because I mean, functionally, most people are getting that anyway with the way that people currently manage their pile-ins after 10 minutes of fiddling. So just do away with the fiddling. That's my opinion.
Exactly. Oh, you're going to set me off now. What else? The getting rid of the wound roll, yes, I completely agree with as well, because Legion's Imperialist doesn't have a wound roll. And it's great. You just roll to hit. It's just harder to hit things. And then you save. And it's much rarer for you to get your save modified. So that works. It's fine. Anyway, we fixed AOS 4. We also have a very sort of follow-up question from that. And this is from Piggy Corrosion. And it says, as someone who's played very little of AOS in general, perfect, I can answer this as well, I'm interested in the stats and meta around having the double turn in AOS. Is there anywhere that breaks down people's win rate? I don't understand that bit of the question, I'm sorry. I've never played any other game that has this mechanic, and it really intrigues me how it manages to keep things balanced or not. I hope this isn't a dark question.
So I don't know if anyone has been collecting stats about like who got priority going into each turn necessarily, but obviously we do have like win rates, and I think there might people might be collecting, like you can.
I think one of the Doomhammer projects does this.
Yeah. In match play, you know from the number of drops that a list has whether or not it will have priority. And priority means that you get the choice of whether you go first in the first battle round. If you go first, your opponent may double turn you. If you go second, you may get to double turn your opponent. I don't know if anyone's really gone much deeper than that. I think the double turn is like a really cool mechanic that makes AOS really unique and interesting. And while it can be difficult to wrap your head around at first if you're used to other war games, it has like you get used to the advantages that it brings as well as the downsides, and as you become more experienced playing the game, you account for it in your strategy and you try to like play so that you're not if you know there's a possibility of your opponent getting a double turn, you won't set yourself up so that you're very vulnerable to having to put up with two turns of your opponent getting to move around and shoot you and kind of pick their battles. And another nice thing is that like if your opponent gets two turns in a row, that's like a whole three turns of your like any spells that you cast on your dudes, like because they last from your hero phase to your next hero phase, like they're up the whole time, so you get things like that. It's really interesting. I think it's balanced. I think all the armies are kind of balanced around it. It's always been really interesting. It just makes me so happy that they did like this big kind of experiment and it continues to reap dividends with like cool dramatic moments. Like every priority role is so tense and exciting.
I love that they've stuck with it, because it is so divisive about the game and a reason why people may not quite consider that it just adds an element of like, oh, something that you don't plan for can happen and you then have to then plan for it. It makes you think ahead to what could happen rather than what will happen almost. And it gives you more eventualities to think about, but you can also use it to your advantage as well. Like, it's not a, like if you get it, then you get to, you've got an opportunity to like capitalize on something, but you can still fuck up in time, or your opponent could have almost prepared you to not have a good time in that situation. And so it feels difficult for them to have balanced at the very least, and it's impressive that they have got it to a point where it works.
I think that the biggest sort of thing about it is that, like, first of all, half the time that it happens, you're going to be taking the double turn. I mean, it's one of those things that's very easy to focus on when your opponent gets it, but just, you know, statistically, half the time you're going to be the one getting it. So it's not like one player or the other is going to be a particularly advantaged by simply having double turn. It's what you do with it. And the only thing that, like, you will get that your opponent will not get is an extra... Well, you get the hero phase and a shooting phase, but those tend to be less impactful in AOS than other systems. I mean, obviously, there are exceptions to this. Some factions are very good at magic, and some factions are very good at ranged. But, I mean, clearly people do learn to work around these things, because there are people who are very good at AOS and tend to win a lot, and you don't do that if the game is fully random. Like, if it was a fully random, then you'd have a fully random person winning every time, but that's not the case.
I had a kind of, like, journey as I learned the game, where I got to the point where, like, nowadays, I'm generally playing well enough that, like, quite often I find myself giving the turn away. Like, if I win priority and I have the I could take a double turn, sometimes I'll just be like, no. I don't actually need to do that, because if I take this opportunity now, I'm giving up on an opportunity later, if that makes sense.
I think that's a lot of the criticism of it almost comes from that very 40k mindset as well, which is you're giving up on a shooting phase, but shooting isn't as important to AOS, apart from when it is, but it's not as often the most important phase in the game, whereas in 40k, that is. And then also, you're not giving up on the combat phase, because the combat phase goes in, like, is always alternating, like, activations for the fights. And that's just a big change that you don't, in 40k, that would be mad to do it that way because of the way the game is structured, but because of the way, AOS is structured, it's not such a big deal that you can charge, but then you might not get selected to fight, or someone might get selected first, etc. And that's always the case in the game. Unless I'm wrong, and I haven't played, because I've never played AOS 3, so it could have changed, but I only ever played AOS 2. And I guess that's what led to the sort of like the activation wars of AOS 2, was that they got kind of hung up on who goes first in fights, that being a deciding thing. And then that's in that interaction with the double turn was where everyone suddenly had to go first in all the fights all the time.
Yeah, I think that is less, there's definitely been a decrease in the number of fights first or activate to fight last abilities in third. They're certainly not absent, but it's less of a case that, like, you're trying to trigger a whole army to fight before your opponent does.
All right, AOS, it's good. So, our final question tonight comes from Rogue Michael. And Michael asks, what makes for the perfect battle tome / codex? And maybe which ones have come closest to it?
Tough question.
I'm going to answer the first bit. You want cover art that slaps.
Mm.
You want
yes.
a ripping good picture of some badass thing standing on some badass place with some badass explosions or lightning or something behind it. And you want colors and you want, you want it to look rad. So that's the first thing. None of this dingy stuff. I want good, bright fantasy bullshit.
I find myself increasingly disappointed by battle tomes, unfortunately. So I'll go back in time and think about, like, maybe what's a good battle tome? They might be one of the ones I haven't even read. Like, I think all of the AOS first edition battle tomes were, like, they had, like, such good cover art. It's, like, really punchy, saturated colours, and, like, a really bright logo, and it just, like, kind of made such a big declaration about the setting. Like, if you go back and compare the art from those Battletome covers to the modern AOS Battletome cover arts, like, there's just so much more colour and, like, contrast. My favourite one is the Beast Claw Raiders one, I think, where it's just like this massive contrast between the ogre at the front, who's kind of like almost yellowy coloured, and then like really vibrant blue and white in the background. And I think because those battle tomes were so much less about the rules, which have always been the bit of the battle tomes that goes out of date as quickly as possible, those battle tomes were like full of bits of lore and art and painting ideas and things like that. And at the time, there wasn't that much about the setting to like use as sources. And so those early battle tomes were like the beginning of the window into the setting. And I don't know, they were just like sort of full of potential, I guess, is what I'm getting at. And yeah, I haven't really felt that more recently.
Yeah,
I'm looking at the art. It's good.
Yeah, I'm thinking about that. Art in battle tomes is such a difficult question because, I mean, it's very difficult to maintain a good stable of artists. And I think one of my favorite books is like one of my first like books I bought for Warhammer was an old army book for Beasts of Chaos, and like, it's got a whole bunch of artwork in it by Adrian Smith, who's just such a good black and white sketch artist. His black and white art is so like vivid and like evocative. And it really sort of like brought you into like the dark fantasy of the horrible beastmen who live in the forests, basically. And that just gives such character to the book and to the faction. And I know that people get criticized for their art a lot, but it's very difficult to like maintain good artists, I think. And even if your art direction is good, you've got to get people who can really like get a faction and like draw out its spirit, I suppose.
Hmm. I really liked the 9th and now 10th edition cover of the Admet Codex because it's so, like, of all of the factions, that kind of just, like, mechanical madness which is on display there, this just massive tech priest, but he's kind of melting into a herd of other tech robots and things like that. I think that is so... like, it tells you everything you need to know about the Admech in that they're just bonkers tech people who just have no humanity left. They're just big robot messes of machines and whatever. And I think that's great out of the modern ones. But I just love the sort of second edition, sort of the bright, that Eldar Codex with the Dire Avenger Exarch on the front and the Blood Angel and, well, Angels of Death Codex with the power squatting chaplain, but it's bright red and it's bright, shiny black and everything is golden and glowing. Anyway, that's just the covers. What's in them is, for me, it has to be just like good lore and just interesting new stories and enough tidbits that you can like hang an army off that idea of the army.
No, I was going to say that, like, I think that, like, the part of the lore that always gets focused on in for factions is like the sort of like the history of this like faction and like the canon events that like make up like, oh, and this, but at this point, like Karl Franz became the emperor and he had a fight with this guy because he didn't like him being emperor. But I think that those sort of like broad strokes are like often the like least interesting part of the lore. Like the part that really gets you interested is like, you know, a story, a one-page story about some crappy loser who's like stuck in this setting and like has to interact with like the spirit, like something that like represents what this faction's really about.
Yeah, like little stories are really what makes it for me. Especially if it's a story written from like the enemy's perspective, where like they're just getting their ass handed to them by like these mysterious space elves or some other unknowable threat, or just like, yeah, I love that stuff.
Yeah.
Really, like it should sort of fire you up and get you excited about playing your army and painting your army and all that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a mix of art as well inside is something that GW do well at this most of the time. But there is definitely been a shift that they've got a certain house style for a lot of things, and they're using very, very good artists who do some wild shit now. But often it kind of all merges into one in that you can't quite tell who did what anymore. And like, you'll know like Phil Moss piece because you could probably look it up and say, oh, he said that one was his. But there's no like, I remember is it the Tzeentch? Disciples of Tzeentch or whatever that second battle tome was. And it had that bright, wild piece in the middle, which was all just comic book colors and bright changing chaos. And it was just so different from everything else in any of the other books. And having a piece of art that is different to the other factions, that tells you something about the faction in the way it's created, is really something else, I think. And that power, like a bit like how like the Cursed City art is really different to a lot of AOS art, and it just sells you completely on that setting, like that faction. But that didn't go across into the faction, really, the Soulblight Vampires. It was kind of like just for that game. But if that had been like the whole style for them, that would have been fucking rad and cool. Anything else on that? Or shall we call this podcast? I think we've done a podcast,
certainly.
Everyone.
Resembles a podcast in many respects.
Excellent. So let's go into the wrap-up phase of this, the morale phase, if you will, where you discover whether we've broken and where to find us. So if we have done that. So you can find Tiny Plastic People at www.tinyplasticpeople.com. No one says the www anymore because they're cowards. You can find me. I am James. I am Alone Music UK on Instagram. You can also find me on Blue Sky, but I've forgotten my handle. Rachel, where can people find you?
So you can find me on Instagram at Rachel Nertia, so RachelNertia, or at rachelnertia.github.io for my blog, because I'm still blogging.
Hell yeah. Alistair, where can people find you?
I'm only on Instagram at Painting Armory. That's Armory with a U. Haven't posted anything there for a while, but I should be posting some pictures of tiny tanks and tiny buildings for them to drive around soon.
Show us the tanks. Show us the buildings. So, as mentioned earlier, you can join us on Discord. We are role models. You can find the link on tinyplasticpeople.com. If whatever we have said has offended you, or you just want to comment, or you want to ask us a question, or you just want to fill our inbox with joy, you can email us at thetinyplasticpeople@gmail.com. And that about wraps it up for this evening. Thank you very much, folk. It's been a lovely chat. I believe we fixed everything, and everything will be great from now on. So, goodbye.
Bye.
Good night, everyone.